From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the state cleans up its mess. Tens of thousands of people wrongly accused of unemployment fraud.
Oh, my goodness. My jaw dropped. I mean, what? For what? I didn't do anything wrong. I couldn't understand it.
Has our infrastructure development turned out to be a great big Ponzi scheme?
The infrastructure investments we have made don't actually create enough wealth and enough cash flow for local governments, for states, for counties, for cities, to actually have the money to fix them.
And a new idea to attract more young voters. Send them a happy 18th birthday, now you can vote kit.
You might be graduating high school, people might be leaving their parents' homes, but becoming eligible to vote, it doesn't really occur to a lot of people. It's kind of an afterthought.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for joining us today. We will hear today from a victim of the state's unemployment insurance system, which wrongfully accused tens of thousands of people of fraud. Later in the hour, we'll speak with an expert who argues that cities and states can't afford to maintain their existing infrastructure, let alone add more, without the political will to significantly increase taxes.
In a sense here, we've grown beyond a problem with a solution, and we've created for ourselves some predicaments.
But first, Ontario Power Generation, OPG, is determined to build an underground storage bunker for nuclear waste less than a mile from Lake Huron. Michigan's congressional delegation's been objecting to this project in Kincardine, Ontario, every step of the way. Now, with a new year and a new administration in the White House, come fresh efforts. Paul Mitchell is the new Republican congressman from Michigan's 10th District. He and other Michigan members of Congress have asked President Trump to pressure Canada to block the OPG proposal. And he is a co-signer on another letter that was sent to new Canadian Minister of Foreign Affairs. Congressman Paul Mitchell, welcome to Stateside.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for talking with me.
Now, you've put a letter together and gotten other Michigan members of Congress to sign it, asking President Trump to do exactly what?
Well, we've asked them to engage with Prime Minister Trudeau and address the issue there, move their dump to a location that is outside the Great Lakes Basin. And in the letter, we were able to get 13 total members of Congress from multiple states. It's a bipartisan letter, asking them to move forward and address with the Canadians the location of that disposal site.
There was also a letter you co-signed that was sent to the new Canadian Minister of Foreign Affairs, representatives of Great Lakes states. This truly is bipartisan. As I looked through the signatories, there's no either side of the aisle on this one.
Oh, no. The Great Lakes is a source of drinking water for about 40 million people. It makes up one-fifth of the world's freshwater supply. Any risk to the Great Lakes whatsoever is a significant problem, whatever way you measure it. And a country the size of Canada, we have to be able to find a location that doesn't risk that drinking water. It's a massive issue.
We've talked on Stateside about the fact that OPG recently submitted a required report to Canada's government. And just to recap, saying in essence, hey, we looked around. There are no other suitable sites. Moving the location would add $5.5 billion to the cost of this project. And by the way, if we did build somewhere else, it would mean tens of thousands of truck shipments of radioactive waste along the highways. And then finally, I'll quote here, there is little interest among the general public regarding the project. What do you say to those arguments?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, $5.5 billion may well be the case, and that may be the most pressing issue that they're talking about, frankly. Yes, it costs money. It will cost money to do anything that puts it in another location. But how do you measure the cost of safe drinking water for that number of people? How do you make that comparison? Suggest that there isn't any interest. I don't know. It took me all of 4 days to collect the signatures of that members of Congress to send a letter to the Trump administration. And as you know, around Washington, some things don't move very quickly, but that was a pretty simple thing to do. There's a great deal of interest. And I think if you check the people around the Great Lakes in Canada, they'd be concerned too.
And I note that there was an attachment to the letter sent to the Canadian minister with a list of the 186 local, county, and state governments that represent, what, nearly 23 million people on both sides of the border, U.S. and Canada.
Sure.
Do you expect a different approach from the Trump administration to this issue than perhaps the Obama administration took?
Well, I think that one thing you can say for President Trump is he expresses himself in a very direct manner. So I don't believe that it would be quite as vague in terms of our concerns. There's a lot of things, obviously, on the plate at the White House. I can't speak for them, but I certainly can say that I certainly hope they bring this matter up. I've had the chance through some meetings to talk with a couple of members of the Canadian delegation here, and have mentioned it to them as well, and we'll continue to push this issue.
And what's your take on their response and their receptiveness to American concerns?
I think more importantly, is, and that's why I appreciate Congressman Kildee's letter, the attachment he provided, which included a lot of municipalities in along the Great Lakes in Canada, I think that's even more important to them when they hear from all these municipalities over there saying, wait a minute, what are you talking about? How can you say there's minimal risk? This is not an issue we can risk.
Congressman, what are you telling people who are opposed to this project to do? What's the best course of action for concerned citizens?
Well, I'd suggest that they contact their member of Congress. They send a letter to the White House asking them to engage. I know there are a number of Canadians that do hear Michigan Radio. I would suggest that they contact their government and they say, folks, we can't play how big a risk game with the Great Lakes. Besides our drinking water, the recreational and business impacts, that would be massive. And there's got to be, in this country the size of Canada, a better place to put this than a couple of miles off Lake Huron. Come on, guys. I mean, let's be realistic about this.
Paul Mitchell is the Republican representative from Michigan's 10th Congressional District. Congressman, thank you so much for taking our questions today.
Thanks for talking with you. Have a good day.
New president, new challenges for America's business leaders, and that certainly includes Detroit's automakers. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us now. And Daniel, just 13 days into the Trump presidency, and you say Mr. Trump isn't making things easy for CEOs. How so?
Well, essentially, he's saying, look, we're going to cut taxes and reform regulations, but I'm going to tell you how to run your business. And I think that, number one, is difficult for them because I think they clearly see a guy who's willing to use Twitter and other ways of, frankly, intimidation to bend them to his will. This immigration ban has put these companies between a rock and a hard place. If they speak out, they're liable to get whacked by him rhetorically. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, there are interest groups that are going to be asking questions and potentially customers, either B2B customers, other business customers that they work with, or their retail customers in the case of an auto company, for example. Ford Motor Company came out very quickly at the beginning of the week and said, this does not comport with our values. General Motors has been mysteriously silent, I think wrestling with how are we supposed to play this. And for now has kind of decided, you know, we're gonna keep quiet. The Silicon Valley tech heavyweights are banding together and saying this just isn't right, and this really complicates our ability to do business. And I don't think that the administration necessarily thinks those things through, and frankly probably doesn't even care. But these are global companies, and Detroit is a global business town. It's easy for folks who have lived here their whole lives in Southeast Michigan not to recognize, particularly if they're not working in the auto industry, that this is a global business town, and that these companies, suppliers, automakers, employ people all over the world, not necessarily in those seven countries that were named by the president's executive order, but certainly in markets all over the world. And they're dealing with this on a day-to-day basis.
And you think of even employees that the automakers and the suppliers have who could be from these companies.
Exactly.
And then you factor in the growing fight with Mexico over the wall and how it's going to be paid for. And as you've pointed out, if you're going to slap a tariff on something, then guess who's going to pay? It's going to be the customer.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I think you just made a very good point. I mean, these companies, while they may not be doing business in a country like Iraq or Iran, they may have employees who came over this country 20 years ago or more who still have family in those parts of the world. And they are not able to see their family. And, you know, this is supposed to be temporary. Will it be temporary? We don't know. We've taken it at face value, say it's temporary, but, you know, what other measures are likely to come down the pike? So I think business is really struggling here. On the one hand, they're hearing a lot of things from a new administration that they like on the economic and business side and regulatory side. On the other hand, they're seeing immigration and other kinds of efforts that are being done that really kind of cramp their style. So they're kind of in a bind as they go forward. And finally, they've got somebody who will use Twitter to shame and to discipline, essentially, if he feels he needs to. And he did it again this morning.
And we have seen that affect stock prices when he unleashes what he calls his big, beautiful Twitter account on a company.
That's exactly right.
Real quickly, you also point out in your column today that if President Trump makes good on his promise to bring jobs back to America, is Michigan a good place to compete for these jobs? And you say Doug Rothwell of the Michigan Employment Development Corporation says we don't have the tools to do it. What are we missing?
Well, a lot. I mean, you know, the hangover from the global financial meltdown when the Granholm administration blanket issued tax credits because they feared, I think rightly, that the industry was going to potentially go away. I mean, you had suppliers that were failing. You had two automakers that went through Chapter 11. And one of the things that they did was issue a lot of tax credits to these companies, which made Michigan very attractive. In fact, you could not reinvest in Michigan with those tax credits. I remember a top executive of one of the car companies telling me that, you know, it is so attractive, you can't not do it. Well, that bill came due, and it shocked a lot of people in Lansing, I think understandably. And as a result, I think they tended to overcorrect, and they cut out some of those things. So now we're in a situation where you've got a new president of the United States who clearly is going to be using his bully pulpit to try and, at least at a minimum, twist some arms of companies to reconsider some of their investment decisions and maybe, in some cases, redirect them to the United States. Well, what does that mean? I think that opens a sweepstakes for interstate competition. So Michigan competes against Ohio, who competes against Indiana, who competes against Tennessee, who competes against, and the list goes on and on and on. So who's going to be best equipped to compete? Well, Michigan has taken a lot of these things off the table, and I've written about this before in other contexts, and there was a push in the last legislature to get through some economic development incentives, which died when then-Speaker Kevin Cotter basically said, I don't support this, and I think these companies need to be able to compete on their own, period. See you later. Bye. I'm done. So now there's a push to resurrect these again. The new president has given them added impetus, I think, is really the important point here.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Still to come, tens of thousands of Michiganders were wrongly accused by the state of unemployment insurance fraud. And for many, the effects were life-changing.
People lost their jobs when their current employer got a notice that they were accused of fraud. And they're like, well, we don't want to have anything to do with anybody that's been accused of fraud. They fired them.
Then, has our infrastructure development turned out to be just a great big Ponzi scheme? That story in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's Unemployment Insurance Agency, the UIA, has wrongly accused tens of thousands of people of cheating on their unemployment claims. And then it began garnishing wages and tax returns, often without the wrongly accused person even knowing what he or she supposedly did. The UIA's director has apologized for the error, but that mistake, pinned on a computer system, has had thunderous repercussions in homes all over Michigan. Take David Vela. For the 11 months he was out of work, he got unemployment. When he went back to work, he stopped claiming benefits. 4 years later, he discovered the UIA had decided he cheated the system of $6,500.
Oh, my goodness. My jaw dropped. I mean, for what? I didn't do anything wrong. I couldn't understand it.
David had moved since he'd stopped claiming benefits. He later learned the state had mailed a fraud determination notice to his old address, and after it was sent back, the state never looked further. Instead, the penalties and interest began piling up to a total of more than $25,000.
As far as they were concerned, I owed the money, and there's nothing they could do about it. I didn't get any reason for the first place I was suspected of fraud because they didn't send it to the right address. They had defaulted everything. So it was like I missed that step of saying, oh, I didn't do anything wrong and trying to prove myself. They just defaulted me.
David's wages were being garnished even though his employer and his union backed his claim that he had not committed fraud.
I've never been so upset and felt so wronged against by the government, and they just didn't care. No matter what I did, no matter what person I went to, there was no help anywhere I could go, and it felt like I was in the middle of a lake with no oar.
It took a toll on him.
Sleepless nights, not getting along with the wife. When they finally did start taking the money out, I had to work overtime, 12 hours a day, on top of not getting any sleep. It was a really tough time.
Finally, with the help of a clinic at the University of Michigan Law School, David Vela got a hearing before an administrative law judge to plead his case. No one from the Unemployment Insurance Agency showed up. The judge ruled the state had wrongfully garnished over $4,800 from David's wages. Finally, more than a month later, he got his money back. Now, he and his wife, his voice of reason, are trying to put this ordeal behind them.
You know, thank God I had a voice of reason with me, and we were able to work overtime and cut down on everything. It's not a good thing to do with people.
taking food out of their mouth, taking, you know, their every day, you know, going to work and doing what they're supposed to do, their families, you know, and sending kids to school and off to college, and it makes it really, it was really tough.
Steve Gray is the director of the Unemployment Insurance Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. And Steve, David's story, I guess, what, take that and multiply it by who knows how many?
Yeah, 50,000, 60,000. They're saying 50,000 claimants or so.
Falsely accused of fraud. And
right.
Here this was the state's attempt to automate or streamline or robotize the unemployment system in Michigan. You couple a computer system with a 93% error rate and Michigan's 400% penalty for unemployment insurance fraud. Highest in the country, right?
By far the highest in the country.
So what did we wind up with?
A huge mess, obviously. We just had so many people, like you said, 97% of that 50,000 people. Actually, I think it's closer to 97% were wrong. And so we just had many, many, many innocent people that were accused of fraud. And the fallout for that is not just the embarrassment or the, you know, the anxiety that people feel, but there were people that actually lost their jobs when their current employer got a notice that they were accused of fraud. And they're like, well, we don't want to have anything to do with anybody that's been accused of fraud. They fired them. So there's been significant fallout.
And hearkening back to David's story, that it seems so many people had no idea they were in trouble.
Right.
None. Until suddenly wages started going away.
Right. That's part of the problem is that the computer went back and looked up to 6 years prior. And so as a result, many people had moved. And so when they sent a notice out saying, we think maybe you've committed fraud, a lot of people didn't get that notice. And so they just went ahead and found fraud. And then the first time that they would ever find out about it would be when they started collecting.
Midas went online in 2013. I'm wondering, in the time since then, how has that changed the number and the types of problems you've handled for people at the clinic?
You know, our caseload has skyrocketed since 2013 and all the fraud started coming through. One of the problems with the way that the current system is set up, there's a provision in the statute that allows people that are denied unemployment benefits to get a state-funded advocate to represent them at a hearing. But if they're accused of fraud, they aren't allowed to get a state-funded advocate. And so as a consequence, people were going unrepresented or they were coming to offices like ours that, you know, we don't charge for our services. And so it's been a huge influx.
So you're accused of unemployment fraud, but you cannot turn to the state's assistance for people charged because it's unemployment fraud. This is like catch-22.
It's a vicious circle.
Steve, let's talk about the lessons learned from all of this and from where you sit, what you think needs to happen, about how the process needs to change here in Michigan, what we can fix now to improve this system.
So we found out that robo-fraud, that you know, the computer making the determinations and not having a real person look at it, was kind of just the tip of the iceberg. You know, we discovered that there were many, many people that when they make a determination after they go off and stop claiming benefits, never get notice. They never find out, you know, that the agency thinks that they weren't eligible or that they've been accused of fraud. And so that, I think, is one area for a big next step is to ensure that people who are accused of fraud are given notice and so that they are allowed to come in and defend themselves. As one of my clients, it's actually David Vella had said, it's always amazing that they could find me when they wanted to get the money, but they couldn't find me to tell me that there was a problem that I could do something about it. The way that they use these cross matches with wage reports and they use Department of Treasury and they use Secretary of State to actually find people to try to get the money from them, they could use those same systems to let them know that they've been accused of fraud.
So it would at least give the person a chance to go, wait a minute here,
right,
and try to keep this from ever happening in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah, and Wanda Stokes has, you know, just made a firm commitment that they're going to do everything in their power to make sure this doesn't happen again, and I think that would be one area. Another area that we sort of discovered as we were looking into this was that 400% penalty, which anybody that's accused of fraud, anybody that's convicted of fraud has to pay not just the money that they wrongfully received back, but they then multiply that by four. And that is by far the largest penalty of any state in the country. The closest state that we have next to that is 100% penalty. And so many states have 25%, 15% penalty. It's pretty clear that our penalty is just way out of line with what's fair. many states have penalties that are graduated so that if maybe you get a first fraud determination, you pay a 25% penalty. And then if it happens again, it's like, okay, well, maybe, you know, you should have known better. You have to pay a 50% penalty or you know, so you could graduate it. But we need to drop it down. And it definitely sounds like the agency is at least publicly saying that they're open to having the legislature reduce the penalty as well.
Is there a sympathetic ear in the legislature that you're aware of?
I think so. Yeah. The robo-fraud legislation that passed at the end of the year was unanimously supported in both the House and the Senate, and it was signed by the governor. So I think there's support. I think the legislature is aware that there's a problem with the agency. I think the agency is aware that there's a problem, and I think everybody's aware that that 400% penalty is just unconscionable.
Any thought of changing the setup where right now, as you say, with the advocacy program won't help you if you're accused of unemployment fraud, but here it is, the state that's falsely accusing you.
Right.
Is that catch-22 something that could be corrected?
Absolutely, yeah. So that was actually a proposed amendment to the legislation that passed and it didn't make it through to the end. But I think that that's allowing advocates for people that are accused of fraud so that they have representation, so that justice is done. I think another part of the provision would require that if, in fact, you are found guilty of fraud, then you have to pay back the amount of money for the advocate, you know, which I think seems fair. But if you're innocent, then the system has done its work and you wouldn't have to pay it back.
So let's talk a little about what might be changed in the investigative process that you think could be helpful, because here we have people that have no idea that they have been found to commit fraud. So what's missing in the investigative process?
So what was missing was any investigation.
There you go.
I mean, just to put it bluntly. So what was happening was they send out a questionnaire to the claimant that has two questions on it. And as far as I know, that questionnaire has not changed. The first question is, did you commit fraud? Now, I don't know. Maybe they're hoping that somebody's going to admit it if they did. But the second question is, why did you commit fraud?
Oh, boy.
Right? And it gives you a list of, I needed the money, you know, somebody else applied for unemployment for me. You know, I mean, it gives you all these possible, but it never gives you an opportunity to explain, you know, why you were overpaid. It never even tells you in that questionnaire what it is that they say that you did that was wrong. So you don't have any idea what it is, and so you can't adequately respond. And then if you don't respond to that questionnaire within 10 days, that's when MIDAS kicked in and was automatically adjudicating people with fraud. What they say they're doing now is they're still flagging them. They're still sending out those questionnaires, which I don't think are worth the paper that they're written on. But then they're also doing a follow-up if they don't get an adequate explanation from the claimant. So they're supposed to make a call to the claimant and potentially to the employer. So that's the new sort of investigative system, which I think is fair. Problem is, if they don't get a hold of them, then they're stuck with that questionnaire. So that questionnaire needs to be fixed. And then if they don't feel like they got an adequate explanation, then they'll charge them with fraud. The question is, well, what is an adequate explanation, right? We don't know that yet. And that's what one of the things I had mentioned earlier that we'd like to find out. So we'd like to get those questionnaires meaningful with some explanation of to what it is they say that you did that was wrong, and then give you an opportunity to explain. And then, you know, figure out what the criteria is that they're using to determine fraud. You know, those are kind of the things that we're looking for down the road.
What do you say to people who hear all of this and think, I don't think if I lost my job, I would ever dare apply for unemployment in the state of Michigan?
Right. There's been a huge, huge chilling effect. And I hear that almost every day from my clients. If I would have known, and that was even for people that haven't been accused of fraud, if I would have known, I'm going to have to pay this all back, because they go forward in good faith and they say, I'm eligible for unemployment, here's my information. And then the employer submits their information, and then maybe 2-3 months down the road, the agency makes a decision. Well, after we looked at it all, we decided you weren't eligible. Now you have to pay it all back. And right now, there's a 1% interest that's charged if you are overpaid. I feel like that's an area where we could make a difference as well, because if you're not accused of fraud, then you're innocently receiving money, you know, from the state. The state's saying you're eligible and they're giving you the money. And then if it turns out later that you're not eligible, that 1% interest, which actually when it's compounded, turns out to be 12% interest. So it's
ouch.
It's quite a penalty just in and of itself,
yeah.
You know. But Wanda Stokes says that the agency is committed to cleaning house and to making sure that people that are eligible get their benefits. And so I guess I would encourage people not to let what's happened to to wrongly accused people chill their interest in applying for unemployment, because you're obviously you desperately need the money. And right now it's just 20 weeks worth of benefits. It's all you can get. And so, you know, you get, it's just meant to be a stopgap until you go back to work. And there's appeals. If you're found not to be eligible, you can file an appeal. Just you go into it with your eyes open and make sure that you let the agency know where the best place is to get a hold of you. Because a lot of people go into it and they end up moving or whatever, and the agency doesn't know how to get a hold of them. And that's when some of the trouble starts.
What should we watch for when you talk about, let's see if the agency does the house cleaning and makes these changes? What are we watching for?
I appreciate the fact that they reassigned the director, but that director had not been there very long. And so I'm not sure that she was at the heart of the problem. And we can say, we can blame it on a computer system. Oh, there's this these unintended consequences, but a computer system only does what it's programmed to do. So that computer system was programmed to make the decisions that the way it made them. And the computer system was programmed to notify people in the way that they were notified. I would hope that the agency gets to the heart of whoever's idea it was to do robo-fraud in the first place and find them some other opportunities, because they're obviously, you know, paying unemployment benefits is not in their wheelhouse. We don't really know. The agency said we're going to review the remaining 30,000 cases. What exactly does that mean? We don't know that. And so I'd like to hear from the agency, how does this review process work? What exactly are they doing to review cases, and what criteria are they using to decide whether or not somebody was falsely accused or not? And then what are they doing to make people whole? They say that they're going to pay the money back. How much have they collected during that period of time? How much of that money has been paying back? I want to hear from the agency as we go into the coming months, you know, how is this process working? And their initial assessment when they reviewed the first 20,000 cases, they said that they only found about 3% of those that had actually committed fraud. So, you know, you would expect those numbers to hold through the rest of there. So that would mean that, you know, 90%, 7% of that 50,000 are going to get their cases reversed and hopefully have any money that was withheld from them given back.
I hear hopefully.
Yes.
So
I'm keeping, you got to keep your eyes open, you know, because I feel very good about the agency's position that they're taking. Mm-hmm. You know, it seemed like at the end of the year, the logjam kind of broke loose, and the agency, when Wanda Stokes got in there, said, hey, you know, we're not going to dance around this anymore. There was a mistake that was made and innocent people have been hurt.
Just to be clear, is Midas still in use or have they stopped using the computer system?
No, Midas is still in use. And, you know, I mean, I think to the untrained eye, you know, if you want to blame Midas, oh, it's this horrible computer system. Yeah. No, it's just the way that it was programmed, you know, and it can be reprogrammed. You know what I mean? So I don't know that it was a waste of $45 million. It's just when you program a system to presume any claimant that applies for unemployment benefits could commit fraud, that needs to be changed. The programming needs to be changed. So I don't have a problem with them continuing to use Midas. I just want them to program it in a way that's consistent and fair.
Steve Gray, Director of the Unemployment Insurance Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. As always, Steve, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Earlier today, Michigan's Unemployment Insurance Agency reached agreement with the plaintiffs in a federal lawsuit over the computer-determined fraud cases. The UIA promises to continue the reforms it enacted since the tens of thousands of false fraud cases came to light. That includes making all reasonable attempts to contact people who have filed claims and revising its forms to make them more understandable to employers and the people filing the claims. The UIA will also delay collection efforts while someone is appealing a fraud determination. There is still a class action suit before the Michigan Court of Claims over all of this, filed by Royal Oak attorney Jennifer Lord. She tells Stateside Today that the settlement of the federal suit is, in her words, a great first step, but there are large gaps that must be addressed.
Creation.
Heart of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
No matter how you slice and dice the numbers, the fact is Americans cannot boast about our voter participation. The U.S. Election Project tells us in last fall's election, about one in every two eligible voters sat it out. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea has something she hopes will whip up interest in voting at a young age. Sandra Stahl and the team at Citizen Detroit are finalists in the Knight Foundation's Cities Challenge with this idea, a Happy 18th Birthday Citizenship Kit. Sandra, welcome to The Next Idea. What is this Happy 18th Birthday Kit?
Hi. Thanks, Cynthia. Well,
The Happy 18th Birthday Kit is an idea to celebrate Detroiters by mailing them a local citizenship kit when they turn 18 and become eligible to vote for the first time. We want to make it a big deal when they turn 18.
What kinds of things would be in the kit?
It would include a local guide to elections, illustrated and fun, that would tell you what does the mayor do, what does the city council do, where can you get registered, where and when can you vote, and how important our local elected officials are to our lives, especially because high school government classes tend to focus on the federal government. It would also include some Detroit-themed gifts and something that you could wear to the polls on election day and upload a selfie.
And I understand, is there going to be a personal message to each recipient?
Yes. We have hundreds of participants in our regular Citizen Detroit voter education programming that are always asking, where are all the young people? Our participants tend to skew much older, more the regular voting population. And so we're going to ask them to identify young people in their lives who are going to be turning 18 soon and write them personal messages about the importance of voting, how important their voice is in Detroit's future.
And how did you happen to enter the Night Challenge with this idea?
Well, one of the key focus areas of the Night Cities Challenge is encouraging robust civic engagement. And I think we got lucky in thinking of what we think is a pretty unique and fun idea, inspired actually by the Finnish baby box, where the government of Finland sent baby supplies and prenatal information to new mothers, to every new mother in the country, actually. And it drastically reduced infant mortality rates. And I'd just been reading about that when the Night Cities Challenge came up. And we were trying to think of ways to reach out to younger voters. And, you know, it occurred to me that when you turn 18, it's a big life transition. You might be graduating high school. People might be leaving their parents' homes. But becoming eligible to vote, it doesn't really occur to a lot of people. It's kind of an afterthought. So that's how the package idea came up.
Now, is this happening yet, or is it still just an idea?
Well, we're a finalist in the grant challenge.
So the Night funding would let you get this thing off the ground. Why do you think younger people are less involved politically?
I think there are a number of reasons. So I work with a church youth ministry, and when I talk to students, there are some who are definitely going to vote, and it's because their parents talk to them about it. And there are others who say they're not going to vote. I know for some of them, they have parents who have not voted before. Or, you know, don't make a big deal about it. I think that youth in parts of Detroit feel really disengaged and feel a lack of agency in their communities, and so feel that their vote doesn't matter. That's what I've heard. It doesn't matter anyway. But studies do show that asking young people to vote and having personal conversations with them does increase voter turnout, and I've also seen that in my own personal experiences talking with students about voting.
So the idea is this package could prime the pump and get them more engaged. How easily might this idea be scaled up to involve other cities?
Well, that's what we hope to find out. A big piece of our grant proposal is on assessment, on really looking at what kind of impact does this project have on increasing voter turnout. Does the inclusion of a personal message make a difference? And so I think that if we can show that there is an impact, that there is a bang for the buck, then there can be a case made for replication and scaling up.
Sandra Stahl with Citizen Detroit. Their Welcome to Voting Age Birthday Kit is a finalist for the Knight Foundation's Cities Challenge, and they'll find out later in the spring if they indeed get some funding. Sandra, thanks so much for being a part of The Next Idea.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Across our state, across our country, we're talking about infrastructure, how it's failing, what that means, and what it's going to cost to fix the infrastructure problems. But what if the issue with our infrastructure isn't that we're not spending enough, but that we've already spent too much and spent it the wrong way? That's the argument my next guest makes. Chuck Marone is the founder and president of Strong Towns. He's a professional engineer, and he's a member of the American Institute of Certified Planners. Chuck Marone, welcome to Stateside. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Certainly safe to say that word infrastructure is probably one of the most used words of these days, isn't it?
Yeah, you hear it everywhere. And in fact, I've started to hear it in really odd places. Anytime someone gets asked, you know, what should we be doing from a public policy standpoint, you can't escape the word infrastructure coming out. It's like the universal thing we all agree on.
I want to ask you to take just a moment to listen to Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder. This is from his recent State of the State speech.
We're at risk in every corner of Michigan for aging infrastructure, and we cannot take this for granted. Michigan residents deserve safe, reliable, sustainable infrastructure. That's why I created the 21st Century Infrastructure Commission last year. The commission did tremendous work. They looked for best practices not just in our country but around the world. They concluded that we need to invest more. We need to literally invest billions of dollars of new investment over the next several decades.
So, Chuck, what do you think's wrong with that approach about pumping billions into investing in infrastructure?
It's fascinating because it's conventional wisdom, and it's hard to argue with on its face. When you step back and look at the problem, you can see that, yes, there's a huge amount of infrastructure in the ground. It is deteriorating and it's failing. And the way we fix that problem, if you define the problem as, you know, stopping it from deteriorating, is you spend lots of money. If we actually dig into the problem, what we find is that the infrastructure investments we have made, and really this is a post-World War II condition, the infrastructure investments we have made don't actually create enough wealth and enough cash flow for local governments, for states, for counties, for cities, to actually have the money to fix them. We'll spend, you know, $1 million on a road, and over the course of the life of that road, we won't get anywhere near $1 million back to fix it. And so when you add up everything we built, you see, like, oh my gosh, we have all this stuff out there we need to go out and fix. But if you actually step back and look at, you know, what our return on that investment was, what we actually got for it, it's like pathetically small. And it actually doesn't even justify the expense of going out to fix it.
I love the term you use, growth Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, because for many, many years, the solution to not having enough money to actually fix your infrastructure was you just go build more stuff. You've got a neighborhood that's falling apart and you can't afford to fix the frontage road. So what do you need? Well, you need another mile of frontage road so you can get another big box store and another McDonald's and some strip malls and some cul-de-sacs with homes on them. And then you can take that money to go back and make good on the promises you made a generation earlier. We're starting to reach the critical end of that where, you know, all Ponzi schemes kind of break down at the end. That's their very nature. We're starting to reach that at the city level and at the state level because we can't generate enough growth to keep it all going.
You actually did a fascinating case study in Lafayette, Louisiana, that proved that that city would have to raise taxes by, what, $8,000 per household just to tread water, just to pay for existing infrastructure?
It's amazing because Lafayette is a fantastic case study. One out of every $5 that the typical Lafayette family makes would have to go just to maintaining the stuff they've already built. So you want the street you drive on to be fixed. You want the sidewalks. You want the pipe to all be there. One out of every $5 you make, about $8,000 more than they're paying now per year, would have to go just to fixing stuff. That's not anything new. That doesn't count, you know, paying for schools or police protection or anything like that. That's just like to fix the pipe. That will never happen. That's an insane number. And so, you know, very much like we have seen happen in cities like Detroit, you're going to have a phase where there's a come-to-grips moment where we can't fix everything. Something's going to go bad. What is that?
Would that case study that you did in Lafayette, would that be representative, do you think, of cities here in Michigan?
Without a doubt. Hmm. The thing that made Lafayette a fascinating case study is that its development pattern is just very post-World War II. It very much captures what kind of a typical American city is. You have an old historic downtown surrounded by kind of traditional walkable neighborhoods, and that was the original city as it existed kind of pre-Depression. After World War II, we started the first highway building phases, and you had the highways run through the middle of the city. You had growth out on the edge. And then in subsequent generations, we've had this kind of horizontal, kind of big bang expansion out from the middle. And you see just acres and acres and acres now being developed quite rapidly with single-family homes spread far apart.
Yeah, no problem coming up with that scenario in Michigan. What's the solution to this growth Ponzi scheme problem that we've got?
I think it's important when we use words like solution to actually maybe better define what we're talking about. You know, problems have solutions and predicaments have outcomes.
Okay.
And in a sense here, we've grown beyond a problem with a solution and we've created for ourselves some predicaments. I mean, the people in Lafayette are not going to spend one out of every $5 they make on infrastructure maintenance. What it means is that we actually not only have to understand the problem, so, you know, you had the governor on, he was saying how they're going to spend a whole bunch more money. I think that that's fine if we understand the problem. If we don't, we're just expanding it. We're just making it worse. So if local government officials can understand the problem, understand their insolvency, they can start to take the money that they do have and invest it in ways that actually pay a return, will actually, you know, be good investments for the community.
Both President Trump and Governor Snyder have advocated these public-private partnerships, the so-called P3s, as a way that you could rebuild infrastructure and not raise taxes. You think P3s can work?
In the short, no. You know, could it work? Yes. But really, the way we're talking about it is wrong. We're talking about it in terms of how do we keep everything we have now and keep it going. What cities have run into, and states too, is that we've run into the kind of this wall of how much we can borrow. You know, we're kind of capped out. If you went back to the early 1950s, cities typically spent about 2% of their budget on debt service. That now, on a national average, is about 18%, and it's growing. And I've seen cities where it's as high as 50%. Those numbers just don't work, and they're kind of endemic of us trying to borrow money to not have to face financial reality. When I was an engineer, I worked on projects like this all the time. We would have, you know, $500,000 a year for maintenance. That didn't get us very far. But if we just borrowed a bunch of money, we could take that $500,000 and spend it on a bond payment instead and then do a whole lot. That's what states have done. What you see now with the public-private partnerships is a way to kind of have corporations borrow the money for you, and then you just, like, lease the stuff back.
So you're not really solving the problem.
No. It's basically like I can't afford to buy a car, you know, and I can't afford a car loan, so I'll go and I'll lease a car instead. Mm. Well, you're still spending the money every month, but you don't have to go through the process of qualifying for a bank loan. That's not solving the problem, no.
Chuck, you have said Detroit could serve as a model for the rest of the country in this. How so?
I say that in a complimentary sense. I think Detroit's an amazing place, and I think what is going on in Detroit right now, while tragic in some ways, is also, you know, beautiful in the kind of emergent properties of just the community relationships that people are developing. Detroit, if we go back, you know, to the early 1900s, is one of the top 3-5, you know, cosmopolitan cities in the world. People came from all over the world to go to Detroit. This is an amazing, amazing place. Detroit got started ahead of everybody else. They were kind of the model for the rest of the country and how to use automobile infrastructure to spread your city out and experience very rapid growth. And Detroit has just kind of arrived at the destination of that a lot sooner than everybody else. Detroit has had to deal with those insolvencies. When you look at Detroit today, you see how they struggled, in a sense, on the way down to try to prop everything up. Crazy debt things they took on, the kind of look the other way on some corruption things just because they had to have the growth. If we can avoid those things and learn those lessons and get to where Detroit is now, where I think they're making a commitment to small incremental investments, to neighborhoods, to people on the ground, I think we can avoid a lot of the pain and suffering that we've seen the last two decades in Detroit.
Getting the lights back on.
Yeah.
Low-risk investment.
Well, when you focus on bread and butter instead of dessert, you can actually improve people's lives with a lot less cost. And, you know, Detroit has had to humble itself in a sense to say, you know, we're going to focus on these basics and make it all work. And I think they've seen positive results from that.
Chuck, if you could sit face to face in front of Governor Snyder, in front of President Trump, both of whom have talked a lot about investing in infrastructure, what would you say to them?
Well, I'm not a political person, and I kind of struggle.
All the better.
Well, yeah. I mean, I know that there is a pressure to solve these problems now. You know, we see this in, like, the medical profession. You go to a doctor, and if the doctor says, you know, what you really need is diet and exercise, we're like, well, no, I want you to solve my problem now. It's a little bit like the same thing with our politics. You know, I would tell the governor, I would tell the president, our cities need a lot of diet and exercise. They need a lot of healthy habits. And the more we can do to help them develop that, I think the better they're going to be. I think the more we feed them, you know, monetary sugar high and, you know, keep them from kind of coming to grips with some of these harder decisions, I think the more we're going to hurt them and the more people are going to suffer in the end. A true leader right now today is helping us develop good habits at the local level as opposed to kind of feeding our worst instincts.
Chuck Marone, founder and president of Strong Towns. Chuck, it was great to talk with you and share these ideas. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thanks so much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our engineer is Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.